Okay, so you remember the Dream Theater?
Oh, yeah. Went to show a lot of times.
Dream Theater was located on Front Street where, let's see.
I remember the Dream Theater when it was first, when I was a little boy.
I remember that Dream Theater quite well. Everything happened when I was 12 years old. The whole world had turned around when I was 12 years old. And every time I go back and try to think of things that happened in the old days, it seemed like I always go back to to 12.
We're going back in time to the year 1944, a year when many a gnome frequented the Dream Theater for entertainment. But the theater was also the site of a historic event, when a 15-year-old girl named Alberta stood up against the segregated seating policy.
How can I help you?
Hi, can you connect me to Alberta Adams' room?
Yeah, hold on, she's right here.
Hello?
Hi, Alberta. This is Barb Amarok in Nome.
We'll hear Alberta's story, as well as the voices of several past and present Nome residents who remember the theater and the discrimination. Welcome to this episode of Story 49. We found out about this story from Nomite Barb Amarok.
There's the old saying that if you learn history well, then you will not be likely to repeat the mistakes of the past. I think it's very important.
In 2008, while she was pursuing her PhD in Indigenous Studies at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Barb took a course with Dr. Beth Leonard called Documenting Indigenous Knowledge. She decided to focus her project on the Dream Theater after she came across an excerpt in a book by Marvin Muktuk Marston, and that book was called Men of the Tundra, Eskimos at War.
The Dream Theater in the 1940s was a segregated establishment. I was working at UAF Northwest Campus, and I had Muktuk Marston's book, and I was looking through it, Joe Amarok, that name caught my eye because that was my grandfather's name, and I started to read the passage about his experience at the Dream Theater, and I got a little shaky. So I had to put the book away until I got home that night, and I read the whole chapter.
And we had Barb reread that excerpt.
Okay. Here's what Marston wrote about an incident of racial discrimination with my grandfather and his family. If he were able to resist the pitfalls of the white man's treachery, he would find himself blocked in every move he made toward economic and social progress by the white man's prejudices. The case of Joe Amarok illustrates the point. Joe was a hardworking, intelligent Eskimo who had built a successful business. He was the owner and operator of the only commercial laundry in Nome. One evening, he took his family to the local movie house, the Dreamland. In this movie theater, the Jim Crow law operated as truly as it did in Little Rock. One side of the theater was for natives, and the other side was reserved for whites. The evening that Joe last attended the movies, he entered to find the Eskimo side full and the white side less than half filled. Rather than seek out singles to accommodate his family group, Joe led his family to seats together on the white side of the aisle. They were barely seated before an usher tapped him on the shoulder and said, "You can't sit here. You'll have to get over to the other side where you belong." Without a word of protest or argument, Joe rose and motioned to his family to follow him. As they left the Dreamland, Joe stopped as he passed the manager's office and said, "You can remove my ad from your screen hereafter. If I can't bring my family to sit together in comfort to see a picture in your theater, then I don't want to spend my money to advertise on your screen." 3 years later, when Joe was relating this incident to me, he said, "I wasn't mad. I was just hurt, sort of humiliated publicly by the affair. Guess maybe I just began to think I was a citizen like everybody else. I've never been back there since. My family just doesn't go to the movies."
And it was that excerpt that got Barb thinking about the hurt that her mother must have experienced, and at such a young age.
I can't imagine myself having gone through what my grandmother and grandfather and mother, aunt, and uncle went through, and their reaction, reading about their reaction in the book, was very painful, and I can't imagine myself having had the same reaction as they did. The first time I read it, I was very shaken by it. My mother was the kind of person who didn't speak negatively. She was very soft-spoken, and I was just imagining that the pain that she felt was very intense. And I think about the fact that it probably caused her to feel some shame and fear and doubt about herself and about her family. And I think I felt like a parent feels who wants to protect a child, that my mother being the way she was, I wouldn't want her to have been forced to feel the way that she was made to feel by that experience.
The knowledge of her own family's experience with discrimination at the Dream Theater motivated Barb to continue learning about others' experiences.
Yeah, when I read that excerpt, I think that was what prompted me to talk to elders, my mother's age, who are still alive. My mother was gone by then, and it prompted me to talk to others who had experiences or knew of the Dream Theater. For my project, I interviewed six elders originally from Nome who had experiences and had knowledge of the Dream Theater. They were Alberta Skank, who at the time was living in the Lower 48, and I interviewed her over the telephone, and her cousin Gary Longley, also Lucy Trigg, all three of whom have passed on since. And I also interviewed Caroline Reeder, my uncle John Celine, and Bill Hogendorn.
Barb asked all of these elders to share what they remembered about the Dream Theater and what kind of experiences they had there.
Good morning, kids. I'm here again for you.
Here's Lucy Trigg.
They showed movies almost every night. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, I think they showed the same one. Wednesday, Thursday, same movie. Friday night and Saturday night were kid movies, like all the other cowboy movies, Cassidy, Up Along Cassidy, and Roy Rogers, Gene Autry movies.
Wow.
We enjoyed them.
My name is Caroline McLean, Reader. There was one boy, Bob Lewis, who we always envied the fact that he got to go to the movies every night. Well, we said, what did you do on Wednesday and Thursday when it was the same movie? And he says, oh, he just went anyway. And we very seldom got to go. Our family just did not have the money to spend on the movie theater. So the only time we ever got to go was when there would be Shirley Temple. When the theater would show a Shirley Temple movie, they also awarded a Shirley Temple doll.
Okay, my name is Gary T. Longley, Sr. They had shows every night. They had what they called shorts at that time. I remember they had a cereal. Shirley Temple was one of the cereals they had. They had Lone Ranger. And then, like I say, every so often they'd interrupt the thing and they'd give away a doll or a BB gun, or they'd have little skits and stuff like that in between, too, before the main movie.
This is Bill Hogendorn.
That was the only theater until the military set them up. They had two or three out here.
And here's John Celine.
We went to the movies. I think it cost 25 cents.
And it wasn't just the movies these elders remembered. They also spoke about the segregated seating.
And we had to sit with the natives with the natives as half-breeds.
The theater was divided into two sections of seats with an aisle down the middle. And when I got to thinking about when that theater was built, if they could have had that in mind, to have two separate sections. I remember the Eskimo people being seated on one side of the building. And it always made you feel kind of strange or odd that why did they have to sit over there? I don't know why people just accepted that arrangement. They seemed to. You just automatically. But then some people were half and half. Where were they supposed to sit?
And in the Dream Theater itself, it was pretty segregated. There were three blocks of seats. The middle block was for white people. The one on the east side was for breeds, quarter breeds and half breeds. And the block of seats on the west side was for full three-quarter and full-blood natives. And then they had a balcony. Normally that balcony is a prime place to sit. All you know, you go to theater, big movie house and all that stuff, and all the hoity-toity sit up in the balcony. Well, that's where the real old natives sat. And the old grandmas and grandpas, they'd all go up there. And so it was limited to them. I remember Charlie Code was the manager. Dick Cornwall was his nephew. And he was the guy that ran the projector. He's a young fella. I don't know, he's probably 18, 19, 20, somewhere in there. And he was the guy that would be the kind of like the sergeant at arms. Anything went wrong, he'd shut the camera down and run down on the floor and take care of the problem.
And the seating, they had a balcony that was strictly for natives. And then downstairs, as you come in, the right side was for natives and the left side for the other people. And the only time you ever sat in the right side or the left side was if all the seats and the balcony were full, then they'll put you way up front, you know. People not liking you because you're native. We never paid attention to that. That was their thing, not ours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't. We didn't like people because they were this or that. They were just people to us, you know, like mm-hmm. we were people.
Yeah.
So the seating arrangements, which was the same in the church anyway, didn't matter to us.
About the seating, different elders had specifically different descriptions for the seating, and I think when you have a subject such as the Dream Theater, the perspectives of people are going to be different depending on who you are. If you're native, you might have a different perspective on how the Dream Theater was operated compared to if you were white.
And these perspectives, of course, especially retrospectively, are formed by experiences. Several elders mentioned witnessing people being kicked out of the theater, or they had memories of their own of being asked to move sections. So what exactly is the story of Alberta? Lucky for us, Barb was able to interview her back in 2008, the year before she passed away.
It was a joy to interview her. She had a good sense of humor, and she talked about how she had gone to the theater and with her date, and they had purposefully decided to sit in the white section, even though she was half white and half native and would have had to sit in a different section.
And who was your date?
He was a sergeant. I guess you would call him a master sergeant. He had three stripes up and two down. I forgot his name.
What happened that time?
Well, the whole theater was full, except there was two seats in the center aisle in the back of the white section. And I wondered, how come there, you know, at the time? I didn't think much of it. And then Police Yenning came and got me that I had to leave.
And then, of course, she was asked to move, and she refused, so she was ushered forcefully out of the theater.
So did they take you to jail?
No, not on that occasion. They took me to jail on gave him the money, and I went alone. And Agnes Galvin, I think, I forgot her last name. The ticket taker met me at the door and wouldn't let me in. And Daddy said, if she touches you, you hit her. And I did. And that's when the police came and got me.
And then, from what I understand, she talked to her parents about it, and her father helped her decide to go back to the theater and try to get back in after she had been told not to come back to the theater. And that was when she was thrown in jail, and her father was right there to spend a few dollars to get her out of jail that night.
And my dad was standing across the street waiting, and he followed us into the jail, and the sergeant there, he fined me $15. I put an article in the paper. I was 15 years old, and I got mad. And I was mad as a hornet at the time.
Alberta's letter to the editor appeared in the Gnome Nugget in March 1944. And it went like this.
Letter to the editor, Friday, March 3rd, 1944, to whom it may concern. This is a long story, but we'll have to make it as brief as possible. I believe we Americans, and also our allies, are fighting for the purpose of freedom. Many of our early ancestors fought for the very same purpose, so their children and children's children, etc., would be free. I only truthfully know that I am one of God's children, regardless of race, color, or creed. You or I or anyone else is not to blame what we are, but we are all proud to be what God has made us. Why was it Thomas Jefferson and his men signed the Declaration of Independence? You or I know for certain that they did not fight and had thousands injured and killed for nothing. It has been known and said through centuries that all American citizens have the right to go, do, and say what they please. What has hurt us constantly is that we are not able to go to a public theater and sit where we wish, but yet we pay the same price as anyone else and our money is gladly received. We are not allowed even to go to public doings, only when money is concerned for the benefit of the so-called society people of our city. Every so often, Red Cross donations are contributed by all people regardless who they are. For the aid of foreign countries surrounding America, we gladly offer and give help to those in need, but when Red Cross social entertainments are given, we are entirely left out. It looks as though we are not good enough to be invited. These people, trying to be so-called society people, are only following the steps to Hitlerism. Signed, Alberta Skank.
Somebody had to do something, I guess. I was so disgusted.
Yeah, you stood up when everybody else didn't. Nobody else stood up.
For years, they put up with that junk.
And Alberta, she was not putting up with it. The day after the incident at the theater, she wired a message to territorial governor Ernest Greening.
The next day, I wired Governor Greening and told him what happened.
So Governor Greening learned of Alberta's experience of discrimination, and so did lawyer O.D. Cochran, who heard about Alberta through her cousin's family.
Well, what happened was my ma's boyfriend was O.D. Cochran, a lawyer. He was in Nome all that period of time, and he became real interested in Alberta's case, so he was a senator. And when he went down to Juneau in 44, 45, he got the Anti-Discrimination Act passed. You need a partner to pass it with, so he got another guy down there to help him out. I don't remember who the other senator was, but the other senator knew Elizabeth Bratkovich, and she had a case down there, so they kind of put the two cases together, and that's when they passed that bill.
I think that Alberta's letter to the territorial legislature had a lot to do with the anti-discrimination law of 1945 along with Elizabeth Paratovich's actions down in Juneau. She also fought for social justice. She actually went to the territorial legislature and talked about the fact that certain establishments in Southeast Alaska didn't allow Alaska Native people to enter. What Alberta Skank and Elizabeth Paratovich did to work toward social justice in the United States was happened decades before the Rosa Parks incident and before the beginning of the civil rights movement in the lower 48. But children in the lower 48 know nothing about Elizabeth Paratovich and Alberta Skank. They're very well versed in about Rosa Parks, which is wonderful. It's they need to know about Rosa Parks, but I think children need to learn about people who've done things that have helped their community. They need learning about people from their own community, region, and state helps them to realize that they are capable of doing positive things for others. I think it also gives them the message that who they are and where they come from is very important. And that it also gives them the message that we don't have to rely on people from other places to help solve our own problems and make our communities a better place.
You know, Alberta, you have a lot of strength, and to do what you did at such a young age is very, very honorable and should be recognized. And you should be very famous, and these young children in the school need to be learning about what you did.
Oh, that's what I heard.
And Alberta, eventually I want to turn it into a project for a school, high school class here in Nome, because, you know, the kids learn about Rosa Parks, who was a black woman who refused to sit. But that was in the 1950s, and what you did was in the 1940s. And so you belong in the history books, even maybe more so than her, because what you did was a decade earlier than what she did.
Yeah, 11 years, I think.
That's right. So she should be called the Alberta Skank of the South.
Well, whatever. It happened so long ago. I mean, well, if you guys want to do that, go ahead.
Alberta's influence on the passing of the 1945 Anti-Discrimination Act in Alaska was no small feat, especially, like Barb said, considering that the Civil Rights Act wasn't signed into law until nearly 20 years later. But as Gary said, a law does not guarantee the disappearance of discrimination.
And then after that bill was passed, then it became, it was illegal to have segregation. So that would have been 45 when that supposedly stopped, but it still happened, you know, not in the theater and not so blatant, but there's been prejudice all along. Matter of fact, there still is some today.
Barb wants Alberta's story to be taught in all schools, especially in local schools, so that students can learn about local heroes. But she also knows that even with anti-discrimination legislation, discrimination is still real, and she urges people in the community to always continue questioning and challenging the things that happen around them, just like Alberta did.
One of the elders that I interviewed gave me the message that they knew back in the 1940s where they were supposed to sit at the Dream Theater, and I'm sure it was not uncommon for people to think that Alberta Skank was making an issue when there didn't need to be an issue. I think it's important for the community members of Nome to understand that we can come to follow ways of thinking that are not best for the community, and we need to be able to recognize that. We need to be able to take a step back and really question whether or not certain practices are for the best and work towards social justice. And if they don't, then they should be addressed.
I hope that I'm as wise as you are when I get to be your age.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling.
Thank you very, very much, Koyana.
You're welcome. I love you.
I love you. Okay. Bye.
This was the final episode of our Collecting Local History series, but we hope it has inspired you to collect the stories of those in Nome and our region. If you have a story you want to share or know someone who might, you can call KNOM at 443-5221 or email story49@knom.org, and we can help you get those stories recorded. This segment has a lot of thank yous attached to it. Thank you, of course, to Barb Amarok for not only interviewing elders a few years back, and taking the time to collect and preserve important local histories, but for also graciously sharing that audio with us here at KNOM and allowing us to bring it to a wider audience. Thank you to all of the elders who shared their perspectives and experiences. And credits for this program go to Tatiana Chenar, who voiced Alberta's letter to the editor, as well as co-producer Courtney Cousins. And music was all found on freemusicarchive.org and included songs by Plankton Watt, Gus Vaughn, Gene Green, and Billy Murray. And our theme is the song Starchild by Mystery Mammal. My name is Kristen Leffler, and this is a special episode for me as well, as it marks the end of my year producing Story 49s for you. And thank you for listening. Story 49, sharing your voice, your story, your Alaska.